Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
Somewhere between science and superstition.
We have such sights to show you.
Strange Eons.
Welcome to Strange Eons Radio. That's Eric over there.
Hello.
That's Vanessa over there.
Hello.
I'm Kelly. Hey guys, you know, we're meeting Carlos after the show, and we're getting group photos, Strange Eons Radio photos.
Whoa.
And I just want you to all know, I notice you haven't said anything. I waxed my nostrils for this.
Oh my God. Now I'm going to have to look, and I don't want to look, and it's not like purposeful. Oh. Sounds real clear there, yeah. Kelly. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Don't show us.
Very nice, huh?
Oh, geez.
Sure.
I did not for mine, and I don't want you to look.
Your nostrils have always been lovely. I've already checked them out.
Oh my God.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, man.
Eric, if you want to use my waxing stuff, you can.
I can't. Oh, I have no response to this. Wow.
No, I did the little razor thing. I don't have the fancy wax, so I might have missed a hair or two.
That's fine. That's fine. My boogers just fall right out of my nose now.
Oh, my God. Good. I mean, you know.
This is the one thing that will make my mom gag. She likes horror stuff, but anything snot-related, she actually starts to gag on. So sorry about that, Mom. The boogers fall right out of my nose, and they get stuck in my beard now.
Okay, my bigger question is, how long is it going to take for them to grow back?
Well, this is not the first time I've done this, so I can tell you.
I can only assume.
It takes about a month and a half.
What? Really?
Is that too soon?
I grow like 2 inches of hair, like head hair in that time.
Yes, but your nostril hair does not grow 2 inches, right?
Oh, fair.
I hope not.
No, I don't know. I haven't checked.
Stick
haven't
your tongue out
any
and to check to see if it's time to... Let's see, do I need to check my nostril hairs?
after this photo with Carlos, I'll find out, I guess. Jeez,
I just wanted to look pretty for the listeners.
Aww,
that's good.
I'm sure they appreciate it.
Vanessa, I watched a movie.
No.
That you've already seen.
Oh.
What movie?
I watched Nope.
Oh, my God. Okay. Tell me thoughts.
Well, so I was prepared to hate this because there were a couple of other film reviewers whose opinions I respect very much, and they came down hard on this one. And they said that we were looking at the new M. Night Shyamalan.
Oh,
that his films have just been getting worse and worse after this brilliant film. And I was like, oh, no. And I watched this and I liked it. I thought it was head and shoulders above Us.
Yeah, I think it's better than Us.
I did not like.
Yeah.
But you left out the best part of the movie, which was the whole Steven Yeun child star story with the chimpanzee.
Yeah, I didn't want to spoil anything for you guys.
That was horrifying.
Yeah.
And far more interesting than anything else happening in the movie. And I kept thinking that Jordan Peele must have had an idea that he didn't know what to do with. Mm-hmm. And he was like, I'm just going to stick that idea also in this movie.
I mean, it's weird though, because the more you think about the other plot, because there's kind of two simultaneous plots, and he isn't the main character, but he's definitely the secondary main character, I feel like.
Yes.
And like the other plot really does balance into it in weird ways that I didn't expect. Like the more because I thought it was stapled on two, but the more I thought about it, I was like, actually, and this kind of adds up, and that kind of adds up, and this kind of adds up. And I haven't gotten as far as a lot of people are dissecting it and going, okay, this is actually a big allegory about Hollywood. And I'm like,
oh,
I'm
for sure.
I think that's correct. I haven't looked at it with that view in mind, but I can see how some of these things do start to overlap in really fascinating ways.
Yeah, I enjoyed it very much. I thought Get Out was a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Us was a real misstep. I wouldn't say this was a masterpiece again, but it really kept my attention. And there were some really strong scenes.
It's no,
oh my God.
Village.
No.
No. And The Village isn't even the worst one. I mean, you've got Lady in the Water and fucking the Wind or the Happening.
The Happening, yes.
The Happening, which I rewatched recently.
Why? oh my God, why?
I wanted to know if I was wrong, and it turns out I was really right. So, like, the idea that the
happening... I haven't even watched it. I have seen no more than, like, four scenes. I'm going, yeah, this is going to be an absolute train wreck.
It's pain. Oh, it's pain in visual form. So the idea that somebody would compare Nope to that is crazy to me.
They didn't like it. The worst part of the happening is not that nature is out to get us. It's pretending that Mark Wahlberg could act like a professor in any kind of
whatever the directing he gave Zooey Deschanel is so bad because she just talks slow and confused. And it's like I've seen her in other things. She's not like Oscar worthy, but she ain't that bad. Yeah. So whatever his directing was awful. He's like, don't really look at camera, look near camera, but not at the character you're talking to, and talk like you're talking with no emotion, but for no reason. And then, you know, it just doesn't cut. Anyways, it doesn't matter. Nope is a phenomenal film, and I am glad that you at least liked it and
got
something.
I did like it. I thought, yeah, there were some really, really strong moments in it. So
there are a lot of reviewers and stuff like that that want to be that, see, I told you,
yeah,
this person is gonna suck. I mean, a weird relate, but I think is very similar. Is like sport happens in sports all the time. You get like a all-star level player, they're like, well, he's not that good. 10 years later when they retire, say, I told you, they really weren't that good.
Oh my God.
Well, and everything is just opinion, Erica.
Oh yeah,
you got on me hard last week for hating on She-Hulk, and I was like, well, I thought that's what we do on this show, is give our opinions of various things.
That's right. And if we disagree with those opinions, we give that back.
Fine. Well,
fuck you. Vanessa, did you see anything?
Now I'm afraid to talk about
it. The second episode of She-Hulk?
I mean, I did, but I'm going to talk about other things. I heard that there was this new Orphan film.
Oh, yes.
But I hadn't seen the first Orphan film. So I saw the first Orphan film, which was fun.
Fine.
Yeah, it was a fun experience with a twist I didn't see.
Oh, you didn't see?
No.
And then you watched the second Orphan film?
No.
Oh.
What? It wasn't that good?
Oh, okay. No, I will. I'm sure I will. So that's on the agenda. But, you know, it's been a short week, so give me a break.
A short week.
No, it's only 7 days.
Just right. Only 7 days this time.
I went out and saw a remake, one that I didn't watch before because I've always been lukewarm with the original series, as the Child's Play remake.
Oh.
Chucky.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of people... Wait, the remake film or the TV series?
Not the TV series. The TV series is excellent. Okay. The film, honestly, was far more entertaining than I thought it was going to be.
Mm.
But, I mean, if you're a huge fan of that original movie, it's not good. It's a changing the reason he becomes.
Yeah.
And then the doll design is something between a 2-year-old and a 75-year-old. The face is so weird.
Yeah.
But I expected it to be pure garbage. So it had nowhere up to go. And Audrey Plaza is it. And she's could be fun to watch in all
too
kinds
young
of
to
shit.
Be a mother, but that's fine.
That was that was kind of my sticking point with
how
it.
How old is she? But I thought she's like 20, at least over 25.
Yeah, the kid's what, 11 or 12?
Yeah, so 16, okay, 17.
Well, all right. Okay.
Have a kid at 13, 14 years old.
I guess I was passing judgment. Maybe I should not have been.
Yeah.
Eric, tell
but
me
no,
this.
That never happens in movies. Ages are always perfect.
Since movies are such a visual thing, we generally try to make that work. What prompted you to watch this movie? That I mean, this kind of came and went, and everybody just went bleh.
I don't know. I mean, it popped up on like Hulu or Netflix or one of those. I'm like, well, let's give it a shot. It falls into that weird thing every once in a while. Like I watched all the Slumber Party movies, and I watched all the Friday the 13th in a row not too long ago, and I've watched every damn Hellraiser movie. I think it just fell. Well, let's see, because the last 2 to 3 movies have been pretty good. A couple of them are really good. And that new show is excellent.
Yeah.
Mm.
So I'm like, well, let's see if there's any. No.
Yeah.
I'd say if you really like any of the things that are related to this, don't watch it. If you're like me, where you're lukewarm on the original, it might be okay.
Well, wow. rousing.
Yeah, that's yeah, a exactly. Solid review.
Solid middle of the road. It's okay.
Copy that.
I caught a Netflix original called Day Shift.
Mm.
Jamie Foxx and Dave Franco.
Oh, that looked super interesting. And I thought it was going to be either garbage or good. What was your takeaway?
I would say right in the middle there between garbage and good.
Okay.
I didn't love it. It's got a very, very similar plot to Night Teeth, which came out earlier that I did like a lot.
Yeah.
The only thing this has going over that is Jamie Foxx, who is, you know, a spectacular actor.
Yeah.
But he's given nothing really interesting to do in this, and I was kind of bummed that the storyline was so basic. And there is a bad guy in this film. I mean, the main bad guy, the antagonist, is nothing.
Oh, really?
Oh, that's
it's one of these things where it's like you're built up. Oh, she's the big bad, and then I guess not.
Oh, wow.
That's like the Ms. Marvel issue, right? That's a Marvel. Like, it's just like, killing. Oh, why did we spend so much time caring about this thing?
Careful, Eric will get all over you for that.
For the Ms. Marvel movie? No, I won't.
I would say two teeth down.
Oh, all right. I like
Wait,
it. I like
but
it.
If you're biting, okay. All right, I'm going to go with that.
It's a good thing, doesn't it? I can't tell now. I don't even know how I felt about it myself.
Two flat teeth, maybe? Not too sharp.
Two soft cow teeth.
I love it.
Is it supposed to be secret that it's about what it's about? Because I...
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
Day Shift?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, okay.
He works for a union of vampire killers, and the rest of the world doesn't know there's all these vampires out in the world. And so there's a couple of scenes that I liked that reminded me of, you know, like what's the British show with the kid who's the gentleman or you know what I'm talking about?
No.
I think I do.
Okay. I'll stop talking.
That sounds the British show I'm intrigued the gentleman. Though.
Not British, it's set in Britain, and it's the kid who learns that his dad was a super spy guy and he gets pulled into the
group. I never saw that, but
that sounds fun.
You've seen it. Samuel Jackson was the bad guy.
Oh yeah. Oh, I know what you're talking about. The not the gentleman, but the I know exactly what you're talking about.
Sorry to all the
I
people
can hear
currently,
Danny yelling it at us.
It's a good film. I finished watching something that I did and didn't finish watching something that Kelly has seen and Eric, you might have finished. the Sandman TV series.
I haven't even started it.
Oh, really?
Because I've just heard so much. Well, some people, the people who really, really, really love it are few and far between, but they're out there. And most of the people are kind of like, it looks really cool.
Yeah. You know, it's really a difficult thing. So I haven't seen the stapled on final added episode. So I haven't seen that. I haven't seen the cats thing. But I liked a lot about it. I think structurally it was interesting to follow story by story. I thought that was really satisfying. But it has the same problem that a lot of British shows have. And it's just too bright. Everything's light. Like the colors pop a little too much. Things are a little too in focus. Everything's a little too clean. And it really detracted from the tone for me of the sort of dirty, grungy, you know, otherness of these people. And on top of that, like Sandman is definitely a little softer on the edges too. He's like a little too, he comes to apologizing a little too fast. Like there's a tonal shift where they're softening a lot of the deeper edges, but then other times it feels like they're going for it kind of. So I don't know. There was a lot to like about it, but at the same time, if you're a fan of the comic, it feels like it's missing something, but it's like it could have been a lot worse. So, yeah.
I saw a pretty cool movie.
Oh, okay.
Another Shudder. Part of the reason I haven't watched Sandman is I'm doing that 100 Days of Halloween thing.
Of
so I'm
course.
Watching.
You have no time for life.
I'll watch Harlequin and Lower Decks came back, you know, stuff like that. But if it's not that, it's like, we'll watch some more. It's called Watcher. It just showed up on Shudder. I believe like last week.
Oh, I think they played this at SIFF and I missed it.
Has the lady, Micah Monroe, or Micah, how are you saying her first name? The lead from It Follows.
Mm. Oh, okay.
She plays, basically she's the movie. She's the main character. She's married. The husband's there quite a bit, but I mean, it is her movie. Mm. She moves into you see them a lot more in British films or German, where they're kind of like a U-shaped apartment complex where you can see the people directly across from you. Mm. And so she notices somebody watching her. It's a pretty straightforward story, but it is really got some great suspense. It's really well told. Mm. It's a Romania, I think, so she doesn't speak the language. So the isolation of her character and the loneliness is so intense. It's just incredibly well done. I was really, really had a good time watching it, as it were.
Wow. That, you know what? That sounds like something my mom would actually really love.
Yeah, could be. Yes.
Did it have more Rear Window vibes, but like eerie?
No. It's more Us or something like that almost, but without the relationship, just the watching.
Wow.
Okay. Supernatural?
Mm.
Oh, no. Okay.
It's pretty straightforward.
Wow.
But just the acting and the directing were really solid, and it's just a well-done, good movie.
Damn. Cool. Mm-hmm. I definitely want to seek that out after I see the Orphan movie.
You know, I would reverse that. Just you know, to...
My mind's already there. I might as well, you know, finish. I feel like I'm halfway through something.
I actually watched Watcher this morning. I was looking through. I looked at Orphan and go, I don't think I like that much. So I looked it up on Letterboxd. I think I gave it like 2 stars.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I'm going to watch something else. So maybe I'll watch the sequel sometime. But
nice.
It's like, why did I watch the Child's Play remake? I don't know. Why would I watch the Orphan sequel? Same good question. I think I'll just watch something I like or might like.
I love that.
Well, guys, I want to take a break. But before we do that, I want to just throw out that, remember last episode we were talking about John Leguizamo and Michelle Rodriguez, and the three of us were bashing on them. Well, our listener, Will Lau.
Ah, yes.
He just decided to send me a little note saying, by the way, you guys are not alone.
Good to know.
So I'm starting a podcast up with him, and we're just going to hate on the two of those people.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah.
Sure.
So, okay, let's take a break. And then when we come back, we are going to be talking big budget horror films.
What is this about big? You know, seeing the big picture, having the big idea, clinching the big deal. Nobody wants to clinch the little deal. Who wants to do that? It'd be a little deal clincher, a small shot. You know, when you go and get a burger, you want a Big Mac. You go to the fun fair, you ride Big Dipper. You turn on TV and you see Big Bird, or you're afraid of the big bad wolf. When I was growing up, I wanted to be the big man. I never wanted to be the little man. Even the little man wanted to be the big man. When you go to America, you want to go to the Big Apple, not the Little Apple. When I get up in the morning, I want a big breakfast. I want my girlfriend to say, good morning, big boy. To which I'll reply, I've got a big day today, a big meeting with a big cheese from a big studio. It's a big time for the big bucks. And she'll turn to me, rolling her big blue eyes, and say, big head. I'll retort, what's the big deal? And give her a big kiss. I'll get into my big car, set off into the big wide world. She'll give me a big wave, close the door of our big house, look in the mirror and ask herself, does my bum look big in this? And in my big meeting, I'll turn to one of the big hitters and I'll say, I love this movie. It's got to be big. There's only one small problem. My fee. I'd like it to be, what's the word?
We have returned. This was my subgenre pick, and the idea was that it had to be a big budget film Now, it could have been a big budget film that did very well or did very badly, poorly, but it had to be big budget. So something like a blockbuster like Jaws wouldn't work because that was a small budgeted film. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, I picked a doozy, you guys.
Oh, no.
It is called Van Helsing.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned.
Van Helsing! You murderer!
Why can't you tell the world I work for you?
Because we do not exist.
My life, my job, my curse is to vanquish evil.
We need you to go to the east, to the far side of Romania, a land that is home to legendary creatures.
I see the Wolfman hasn't killed you yet.
Don't worry, he's getting to it.
Lorded over by Count Dracula.
It is a place where nightmares come to life.
Van Helsing.
He's the first one to kill a vampire in over 100 years. I'd say that's earned him a drink.
Now, a man without a past.
Do you have any family, Mr. Van Helsing?
I hope to find out someday. It's what keeps me going.
Will face an enemy that never dies.
In 1462, Dracula was banished to an icy fortress.
And then the devil gave him wings.
And uncover a secret he never imagined.
Castle Dracula.
Hello, Gabriel. We have such history, you and I.
How do you know me?
From the director of The Mummy and The Mummy Returns.
Oh my God.
Hugh Jackman. Kate Beckinsale.
How do I kill him?
No one knows how to kill Dracula.
If you're late, run like hell. Don't be late.
A film by Stephen Sommers.
Oh, Lord.
From 2004. a budget of $165 million. Worldwide box office of $300 million. The Rotten Tomatoes critics give it 24%, and the audience gives it 57%. I'm going to be upfront with you guys. I actually enjoyed this movie quite a bit.
Oh.
And I have thoughts on it.
Okay.
Have you seen it?
I think I saw it in the theater?
I did see it in the theater.
Okay.
I did not because of all the very bad reviews.
Sure.
I think I probably would have hated it also.
Back then. For sure.
This was written and directed by Stephen Sommers. He's got a pretty good Hollywood blockbuster pedigree. Deep Rising, The Mummy Returns, just tons of big movies. It stars Hugh Jackman.
Mm-hmm.
He played Wolverine in a movie or two, but you probably know him best for his star-turning roles in one episode of Blue Heelers or the single episode he was in of Halifax FP.
I think, wow, I got to check that episode out.
Also, Kate Beckinsale, who was in almost all of the Underworld movies, Serendipity, and Republicans, Get In My Vagina.
What? Okay.
That must be it.
And also, Richard Roxburgh, who plays Dracula in this, he was in Sanctum, Moulin Rouge, and he just played Elvis's dad in the new Elvis movie.
Oh, yes.
So, this story starts out in black and white. We show up basically at the ending of the movie Frankenstein, the laboratory and Frankenstein and Igor, but also their mysterious benefactor, Count Dracula. So there's this very cool scene where the villagers are storming the castle with torches and pitchforks and all that. And Dracula and Frankenstein's monster start fighting. Frankenstein himself is killed, and Dracula and Frankenstein's monster fall down the big windmill, the burning windmill at the end of Frankenstein and all that stuff. And I have to say, you guys, I was like, hey, I am fucking all in on this movie. I loved how it started. Then we are introduced to Gabriel Van Helsing. I have thoughts on this. It's a very stupid name change.
Yeah.
It makes sense later on, but the sense that it makes is also stupid. So I was just furious. He works for the Vatican. He's killing monsters. And when we first find him, he's on the hunt for Mr. Hyde in France. We get this big fight right up front with state-of-the-art CGI effects, circa 2004. And after he kills Hyde, the police are after him for murder. And this seems to be what happens all the time. He's wanted all over Europe as a mass murderer because no one knows about the monsters roaming their hillsides, but they see the human bodies that he leaves in his wake. A quick aside, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was made by MGM, not Universal, so this seemed weird to me.
Huh. Oh, huh.
So after that, he gets called to the Vatican, and they bring him down to this secret room, and it's super fun. It's basically a Catholic version of Her Majesty's Secret Service. And there's all these monks in this room trying out new weaponry like James Bond would have in the 1800s. And he even gets his version of Q, who is played by David Wenham, who I immediately recognized as the one-eyed narrator in the movie 300. He's the one guy who survived that Leonidas sent away. Only here, he's super short. It makes me wonder how tall he really is because he's playing this kind of bumbling, nervous friar named Carl, who has created all of this weaponry for Van Helsing. So he's got this kit that's got holy water and a silver stake and a crucifix and this amazing automatic crossbow that looks like a Gatling gun full of arrows and everything. And he's been sent to take down Dracula and Transylvania. So it's just a really super fun setup. I'm loving everything so far. There is all this mumbo jumbo that Dracula has to be stopped in order for the last descendants of this Transylvanian knight to actually get into heaven. But really, it gets in the way of everything. And it's just, it is literally just an excuse to get him over to fight Dracula. I feel like it could have been many other reasons, and this just gets in the way. Anyway, he and Carl, they arrive in Transylvania, and they are immediately attacked by the townsfolk who do not like strangers. But they are also suddenly attacked by Dracula's brides, which are these kind of harpy-looking women bat things that are flying through the air and attacking everybody. And it's pretty cool. And anyway, this gives Van Helsing a chance to fight them off while they're trying to kidnap the very beautiful Princess Anna, who is an ass-kicker herself and looks just like Kate Beckinsale. So he actually kills one of the brides and the other ones take off, and that makes him even more unpopular with the townsfolk because now Dracula's going to be super pissed at them. Anna is cool with it though because they just saved her life, so she takes them back to her castle, and she's telling them about all the stuff that they are trying to do. They know that Dracula's a vampire and all of this stuff. There's she and her brother are werewolf hunters. And later that night, her brother attacks her. He has been turned into a werewolf. When Van Helsing shows up and is about to kill her brother, she stops him and says that Dracula has a cure for werewolfism. And so he decides not to kill him. And they are like, okay, this is now why we have to go get Dracula. And this seems like this could have been the reason that they had to take him out. And they didn't have to have any of this other bullshit.
Huh.
Princess Anna, it turns out to be the descendant of the Transylvanian knight. And so if she dies, she won't go to heaven unless Dracula is killed, according to this prophecy.
That's so clunky.
Super clunky.
Oh, Lord.
So the movie just gets into some ridiculous fight scenes and Dracula being very evil and all of that. And, of course, the Frankenstein monster comes back. And I got to say, you guys, he looks fucking great. He's got, like, this see-through dome on the top of his skull to cover his exposed brain. And there's all sorts of electricity that's like bzzzing around all over his brain all the time. I just love the design of it. By the way, everything looks cool in this movie. The werewolf design is super evil. Definitely takes its nods from the American Werewolf in London werewolf, which is a very cool looking werewolf. And Dracula is pretty cool too. He's got long black hair and he's always dressed nice. The movie is nothing if not stylish.
Oh, that's good.
So
I'm glad Dracula's dressed nice.
Well, I'm just saying. Dress cool for the job you want.
Got it.
So Dracula, of course, will get a hold of Anna and persuade her to be one of his brides. And Van Helsing and Carl will have to rescue her and all that shit. And then we find out that Dracula needs the Frankenstein monster to get the secrets of reanimation. because we are shown that he has a ton of baby vampires hanging in these bizarre placenta bags.
Ew.
But they need to be animated to fully become dead. I don't quite understand all of this stuff. I didn't understand the whole idea of vampire babies, but I kind of liked it. But then the idea that he had to reanimate them with the Frankenstein life essence was hard to wrap my head around. It's just stupid. But the vampire babies look great, so who fucking cares, right?
Yeah.
Cool.
Dracula does get the monster and drains his life to animate the babies. But the monster gets free, and we get to the third act climax, which is just a, 28-minute long fight scene between everyone. So Van Helsing and Dracula are fighting. Anna and one of the brides, who was a friend of hers, they're fighting now. And the Frankenstein monster is there, and even Carl is fighting off vampire babies. And it's a really fun monster fest of a third act. I had a really, really great time. And then to really cap it off, we find out that as Van Helsing is losing to Dracula, he pulls a man with the black mask and suddenly reveals that he allowed himself to be bitten by a werewolf. And now he turns into a gigantic werewolf.
Oh, my God. Jeez.
It's like, but I'm not left-handed. The best part of his werewolf design is he's all black and everything, but he's got this furry patch in his chest that's kind of in the a gray furry cross on his chest.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Vanessa, will they defeat Dracula and save Anna and get Van Helsing the werewolfism vaccine in time?
Yes.
They only pull off two of those, and the one they don't pull off might surprise you because it surprised me.
Wow.
Yeah, I was like, oh, interesting.
Sequel setup?
Well, yes, but without a specific character.
Okay.
Remember, he has to kill Dracula in order for the descendants to get up to heaven if they die.
Okay, fair point.
So it kind of pays off in the end, but it still was a stupid idea, and that person did not need to die. I thought this was a super fun movie. I think the problem with it is it's 10 years too early. 2004, it was just too much. If this is released in 2013 or 14, when we are all stupid because we have watched too many Marvel movies and we think that those are the best movies, this would have been a fucking gigantic hit because it is literally just a Marvel movie with the Universal Monsters.
Oh, wow.
Wow, that's incredible. You know what? I have definitely not seen this movie. The more you described it, I was like, Did not, do not have any memories of this.
I think that Hugh Jackman was a good choice for this character, but it's too early in his career. We hadn't fallen in love with him as much as we have now.
Sure, yeah.
And I think that we would have been a lot more forgivable about this. About how stupid this is. It's the Ryan Reynolds effect.
Right.
Right now he can do no wrong.
Right.
But 10 years ago, he was making some real shit movies, even though he was playing the same guy.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. It's like all those video game films or, films about CGI or computers or whatever that were obviously like 10 to 15 years too early.
Yeah.
It's oh man, if this plot had come out, The Net has such a good opening where she orders that pizza online. Let me tell you, I loved it.
So make no mistake, not a good movie, but better than the last Thor movie. So,
not hard.
Right. So the stupid thing about the Gabriel name change is that they keep on hinting that Van Helsing is something other than just a man.
Oh Lord.
He's got these memories that would make him thousands of years old. And it's designed to build some mystery around him.
It's
completely superfluous and unnecessary. And it just gives the audience one more thing to roll your eyes at. And I think that's where, I think that's how people rate a movie is they're like, oh God, it was stupid, but it was really stupid, So you got to watch that shit in your scripts. Just a couple of items of trivia here. And make no mistake, I did really enjoy it. I had a great time with this movie. The place where Van Helsing and Anna fight Dracula's three brides is the same stage where Frankenstein, Dracula, and the Wolfman were filmed. The set is called The Court of Miracles, and it's part of the studio tour at Universal Studios Hollywood.
Oh, wow.
The film was intended to start a series of Van Helsing adventure movies. Mm-hmm. However, the reviews were bad. And box office returns were far below expectations. All plans for a sequel were dropped within several days of the film's opening. There was an animated prequel movie that went straight to DVD. There was a video game that I guess is really bad. The North American DVD sales were $65 million in the first week, more than half the revenue from the theater run.
Wow.
So, did all right there. And then Stephen Sommers claimed in an interview he changed the main character's name from Abraham Van Helsing to Gabriel Van Helsing, as he did not think he could have a lead character named Abraham.
What?
Let me just point out that the man who wrote Dracula was Bram Stoker, and Bram is short for Abraham.
Wow.
You can use the word Abraham.
Yeah.
In fact, I think the name Abraham holds a little more weight than Gabriel, which sounds a little too modern to me.
Yeah.
Even though it's an angelic name.
Right.
That was my movie. It was a very expensive movie that did not do very well.
Wow. Okay. Well, I went and saw a I sat and saw a film that I've been wanting to see for a while, and I keep not being allowed to see this movie because it's too big of a movie. So this was a great opportunity. Thank you so much, Kelly, to finally watch again since the 90s, Interview with a Vampire from 1994.
How about you say we get started?
So you want me to tell you the story of my life? I'll tell you my story. I'll tell you all of it.
Gee, Ralph.
I'm flesh and blood, but not human. I haven't been human for 200 years.
From the novel by Anne Rice. From Neil Jordan, the director of The Crying Game.
I've come to answer your prayers. Life has no meaning anymore, does it?
His name is Lestat.
But what if I could give it back to you? Pluck out the pain and give you another life. One you could never imagine.
I can see you lying on a bed of satin.
He chose one man. He gave him infinite power. Eternal life. And a daughter who would be forever young.
This is the only real evil left.
And then he took the light of day.
You're a vampire. You never knew what life was until it ran out in a red gush over your lips. Can't stand this any longer.
You made us what we are, didn't you?
God kills indiscriminately, and so shall we.
Do you like dying? You condemn me to hell.
Monster. Unhappy family.
Take her, Louis. End her suffering and yours. For do not doubt.
Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt, Stephen Ray, Antonio Banderas, Kirsten Dunst, and Christian Slater. Interview with the Vampire.
Have you guys seen this movie like recently?
Recently, no, but I think I've seen it 8 or 9 times.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Several, many times.
Okay. So this has a Rotten Tomato score, 64% from critics, so actually not crazy high, but 86% from audiences who dug it. The budget was $60 million. The box office was $223.7 million.
Mm-hmm. Not too shabby.
It went well,
yeah.
Which is kind of surprising because the director was Neil Jordan, who, looking at his previous work, I would not have picked him for this film, but that's okay. He did great. He did Mona Lisa, The Miracle, The Crying Game, Michael Collins. And then more recently, he's worked on 6 episodes of The Bourgeois. He has sort of disappeared for a while, but it seems that it's because instead of doing directing, he's been really busy writing. And he did 21 episodes of something called Riviera and 29 episodes written of The Bourgeois. So he's kind of skipped on over the other line. written by, of course, Anne Rice. 10 screen credits. She's obviously a very well-known writer. Her books have been adapted into such films as Exit to Eden, Rag and Bone, Queen of the Damned, Lestat, a short film, and The Young Messiah. It was also written by, but we're not allowed to say it, Neil Jordan, who heavily rewrote the script, but due to Writers Guild rules, he was not allowed to get a credit.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah. So he could not have his name anywhere on there, which I don't know how he felt about that. It stars some heavy 90s hitters. So Brad Pitt, 84 credits. We have talked about him in Cutting Class, but he was also in Freddy's Nightmares, Tales from the Crypt, Cool World, Johnny Suede, and is just generally known as being one of the most attractive human beings in existence. Tom Cruise, 50 credits. He's just unbelievably famous, and he also leads a cult. So there you go. If you don't know who Tom Cruise is, we are in the far-flung future, and somebody is listening to this off of their future podcast device. And man, I hope the world is okay. It also starring Kirsten Dunst. This is a pretty early role for her, although she was a child actress. 87 roles, so she actually has been in a lot of stuff. We would all know her as Mary Jane in the Spider-Man films, or more depressingly, as in Melancholia, or even more depressingly, recently in Power of the Dog. Also, though, as a kid, she was in Star Trek Next Generation and Little Women and Jumanji, a few episodes of ER, and was also the voice of Kiki in the English language version of Kiki's Delivery Service. Jeez. Pretty cool. We also have Christian Slater, 139 credits, including Heathers, Tales from Dark Side, Young Guns 2. He's been around. And Antonio Banderas in a pretty early role for him on this side of the pond. So Spanish actor who is pretty big over there before he managed to break into the American scene. And since then, he's, of course, been in things like Desperado, Assassins, Mask of Zorro, and all the Spy Kids movies and all the Shrek movies, which, by the way, so many more than I thought. Okay, Shrek 2, Shrek 3, Shrek in the Halls, Shrek Ever After, Donkey's Christmas Shrektacular, Shrek's Yule Log, Puss in Boots. And in 2022, Puss in Boots, The Last Wish. So look out for that. That's, I'm guessing, coming around Christmas time. The plot. So we start on a sort of people's eye view of San Francisco. A lot of people are just walking street level. Seems like it's a big set, but I don't know. And we make our way up to an apartment. We swing up old camera style, big jib, to a man looking out upon the streets and a reporter setting up his equipment. The interview is going to be with Louis de Pont-de-Lac, which I don't know, who claims to be a vampire. To prove his supernatural abilities to the reporter, he moves around the apartment faster than light, faster than the speed of the eye, and then settles in to start his story from 1791. And the reporter is like, cool, take me on a journey, crazy man. And I have no idea why this guy is reporting on him or what. Apparently he's been following him for a little bit, but there's zero context as to why this is actually happening. And that's fine, I guess. So 1791, we go to New Orleans. Louis' wife and child have died. He is incredibly depressed and spiraling out of control. He is a plantation owner. And is basically doing all he can to seek chaos and death for himself. So, unfortunately, instead of just dying, he picks up the interest of the vampire Lestat. Lestat, instead of offering him death, offers him eternal life, allows him to drink of his blood, and gets him to turn into a vampire. Basically, Lestat's doing this because he is bored and lonely. And I don't know why he chooses Louis to be his, like, friend, because he seems like a very different kind of guy, but cool. So Louis eats a person, then feels bad. So then he attempts to live off of rats and other animals. Lestat finds this incredibly irritating because he's like, dude, just eat some bros with me, man. And Louis's like, no, man, I can't. Louis spirals into a big, big depression. which leads to them having a big, big argument, which leads to Louis wandering off into a sort of plague-infested part of the city where he finds a child holding onto her dead mother's hand and asking, you know, hey, mister, help my mom. She's not doing good. And her mom's like jaw is like rotting off, like clearly been dead for a while. He's really hungry and desperate and sad. And so he decides to eat the girl. So he has given into temptation and out of nowhere, Lestat shows up laughing at him. This is hilarious, I guess. So then Lestat seizes the opportunity and decides to go ahead and make them both a daughter. And then we get into this really cute sequence of the film where it's basically just a gay couple like raising their daughter and having like quirky bouts. I don't think they're meant to be gay, but damn, guys, if it was made today, it would be real gay. So, of course, this does actually end up calming down Louis, who loves the girl completely, loves being her father figure. But of course, Claudia eventually grows up, but is still a child, and she resents her situation. She is forever going to look this age, be this size. Even her hair cannot change. So in her fury, she decides she must kill Lestat and free them both of his chaotic ways. They don't quite manage it, and then so they decide to try and burn him on top of, like, poisoning him, and that, that looks like it's not going well. And then Lestat is basically burning down a huge section of the town because he's just running around on fire. And so they hop on a boat to Europe. So that's fun. They then go trying to find vampires everywhere, cannot find them. But funnily enough, weirdly, in Paris, where Lestat said he was turned into a vampire, they by accident find vampires. Shocking. Just when Louis was ready to give up. And hot vampire Antonio Banderas is there with a group of really bad theater actor kids who are also vampires. And they welcome with open arms Claudia and Louis, but then quickly close them again when they discover that they have potentially killed another vampire. They lock Louis up in a coffin and wall him into a section of this underground, I think it's the catacombs, while also giving Claudia her just returns. Louis is enraged by the entire situation, and when he is let out, eventually, he takes revenge on all the vampires and kills them while they're sleeping. Of course, Antonio Banderas is like, damn, son, that be hot, yo. I like you a lot. Why don't you come hang with me? And he's like, nah, brah, I gotta go live a solitary life. Bye. So he goes off back to America. And this is how we eventually lead many, many years later to him having an interview. But there are questions that loom. Is Lestat truly dead? Will the interviewer live to tell the tale? Who knows? Okay, so I think I would have really liked this in 1994. In 22? it's real bad. I mean, it's not like bad. There are good things in it. There are definitely good things in it. But the pacing is such a mess. It's like, hey, everybody, we're having a great time. I hate everything. Like, in a second. There is no time to breathe. You never really get to believe anyone's emotional state or any of the situations. Nothing settles in. The budget is clearly shot directly, not only into the actors, but also these huge sets, these city streets, these just big, big looking places. They have a plantation, a French home, a plague house, underground caverns. They crafted tons of props, tons of lights. There's just so much going on in here visually that's definitely cool, but also looks really stagey. You constantly feel like you're kind of watching the stage play, especially from the shot sizes we live in. Nothing feels close or real or intimate. There's a very questionable Creole accent coming out of Brad Pitt's mouth. Bless him. He's trying. However, on the flip side, Tom Cruise loves this role. Yeah. He is having the goddamn time of his life with it. And I think he really sells Lestat in a way that... it's just fun. He just does such a fun version of this. And Antonio Banderas, this might be his hottest role. I think he looks incredible in this. He does great as this sort of, Euro vamp. Tandy Newton is in it for a sec. That was fun. I was like, hey, that's Tandy Newton. You will become famous later. And I am glad I saw it, but I don't think it had a lasting artistry. It actually feels a little hokey and artifice. So
this was a first time viewing for you.
I saw it on VHS when I was in middle school. So yes, I'm going to say it was a first time viewing.
Close enough. So no feelings of that actual first time you saw it.
No, the nostalgia was, I mean, I vaguely remembered certain plot beats, but not very strongly. So it really felt like a first time watching for me. So a little trivia, tagline, drink from me and live forever. The rights to Rice's novel were initially purchased by Paramount Pictures in April of 1976, shortly before the book was published. However, the script lingered in development hell for years, with the rights being sold to basically Warner Brothers ended up with it. Director Neil Jordan was approached by Warner Brothers to direct after his huge success of the movie The Crying Game in 1992. Jordan was intrigued by the script, calling it really interesting and slightly theatrical.
Saying he leaned into that?
I think he might have. But was especially interested in it after reading the novel. He agreed to direct on the condition that he would be allowed to write his own script, though, as I mentioned earlier, he did not get a writing credit. With David Geffen producing, the movie was given $70 million budget, unprecedented for a film in the vampire genre. Jordan stated that it's not very often you can make a complicated, dark, dangerous movie and get a big budget for it. Vampire movies were traditionally made at a lower end of the scale on a shoestring and rudimentary sets. David Geffen is very powerful and he poured money into Interview. I wanted to make it on an epic scale and something like Gone with the Wind, which does also kind of make sense with the big plantation scenes as well. And you know, just a fancy rich person crying while their slaves are like in the courtyard kind of supporting them. I don't know. It's weird. The visual effects were actually overseen by Stan Winston and his team. Winston designed the character's vampire appearance and the makeup effects, including a technique for stenciling translucent blue veins on the actor's face. This required the actors to hang upside down for 30 minutes at a time so that the blood would rush to their heads and cause their veins to protrude. That enabled the makeup artists to trace realistic patterns over the top.
That seems a bit extreme.
Yeah.
Yep. And apparently, once they got back upright, often it would disappear a little too quickly, and they'd have to do it all over again.
How about a anatomy book, and you can just paint fake veins where you know they're supposed to be?
Are you questioning the great Stan Winston, sir?
Hanging upside down, maybe just take a quick little thing and go over the face. Okay, there we go.
All right, good. Or at least like quickly stencil it in, and then like let them sit, and then. Yeah. You know, I don't know.
Oh, well. Whatever. We don't work for Stan Winston. What do we know?
No. His company also created the CGI flames burning the plantation. Ooh. And Claudia's transformation, which looks like a crossfade. And the charred remains of two vampires, which does look cool. There's a moment where you see two vampires who are like holding each other charred and just, and it was taken / made off of a photo of the victims of Hiroshima, which is very cool. Brad Pitt said to EW that he had a miserable experience while making this film. He recalled the discomfort of the makeup, colored contacts, and particularly filming in an enclosed, dark indoor area. At one point, he called his friend and producer, David Geffen, and begged him for a way out. But learning that it would cost $40 million, he toughed it out and remained for the remaining months. So... There you go. Christian Slater was given the role of Malloy, the reporter or the interviewer, upon the death of River Phoenix, the original choice for the role. Slater donated $250,000 of his salary to two of Phoenix's favorite charities after the film. And also, Anne Rice was pretty pissed at the idea that Tom Cruise was going to be cast. She was livid and stated that Cruise could not carry the part, calling the casting so bizarre it's almost impossible to imagine how it's going to work. And, quote, the worst crime in the name of casting since Bonfire of the Vanities. Rice recused herself from the production and did not view the film until a producer sent her a VHS copy. Rice was so impressed by Cruise's performance that she wrote him a letter of an apology and recorded a 2-minute video endorsing the film that was included as a pre-feature on the mid-1990s VHS release of Interview with a Vampire.
Didn't she also take like full page ads out in a few newspapers apologizing?
She did. I think it was, I want to say it was the New York Times or Vanity Fair or something. Yeah, she really got behind that film. Unlike Queen of the Damned, which she was pretty upset by and very publicly dissuading. I will say that one interesting thing after this film, a real-life crime happened shortly after the film's theatrical release. In 1994, a man named Daniel Sterling and his girlfriend Lisa Stellwagen watched the film together. The next day, Sterling stabbed Stellwagen 7 times in her chest and back and sucked the blood from her wounds. Fortunately, Stellwagen survived, and Sterling was arrested. He claimed in court that the film influenced his plan, and the jury convicted him of attempt of first-degree murder, among several other charges. So,
did he turn into a vampire?
You know what? It didn't say. But this would be the highest-grossing vampire movie for over a decade. However, as of 2016, it's also the highest-grossing rated R vampire film of all time. So,
well, I think this is a good time for me to say you're fired, Vanessa.
Oh, no. I knew.
It has been a long time since I've seen this, but I remember loving it when it came out. Eric knew me then, and I was like, that's it. I'm growing my hair long.
Oh, my God.
And then he, because Eric had Lestat and Louis length hair back then.
Oh, yeah.
And
like Banderas.
My hair touched about the middle of my neck, and I started wigging out about it, and he said, I don't think you're going to make it, son.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a rough period.
You know, I remember in high school, my high school boyfriend got all of him and his friends got really into Interview with a Vampire, and there was a lot of long leather coats and long grown hair happening at that point. So you were not alone, though they were a little late to the game.
I always thought the leather coats was a weird choice. Shouldn't be wearing like puffy sleeves.
Yeah.
And
hey, let me tell you about some of the dances we went to.
They were doing Lost Boys, not Interview.
No. There were moments where fake vampire teeth were bought from Hot Topic and blood and puffy shirts. They did show up at various points, just not day-to-day school life. So
I was a really, really big fan of the book before the movie came out. Mm-hmm. And I was along there going, Tom Cruise, what the fuck?
Sure.
And then I really liked him in it.
Yeah.
Are you aware that there is a new television series coming out based on it?
There was, in the Wikipedia, they mentioned all kinds of stuff that had like stopped and started. And it did mention something about a TV series, but I didn't hear that it was happening.
It looks pretty bad, not very faithful to the story. But cool. I'm like, okay, why wouldn't you then, if you're going to do this, it must be a rights thing, take The Vampire Lestat, which is the second book in the original trilogy, and turn that into your TV series? Because the 3/4 of that book is Interview with the Vampire, but told from Lestat's point of view.
Oh, interesting.
And I'm like, look, you can make this same movie, but now let's get some rock and roll in here and, you know, a vampire who loves being a vampire.
Yeah. So
the book, Louis is a real downer.
Oh,
he hates this. Interview was the book that started the whole, I hate being a vampire.
Oh, interesting. Huh. Which, I mean, obviously, like, watching this film really was like, oh, wow, Angel from Buffy is just this, right down to eating the rats. I was like, oh, and, like, the plague-infested city and, like, hiding out in the, like, scum of the people. I was like, oh, you're just exactly this thing.
Yep.
Which is cool. But,
I
do know.
I'm sorry you didn't like it.
Good luck with your next
podcast, Jeff.
Oh, man. All right. Well,
it'd be funny if you watch it again next week. Oh, shit.
God damn it. She was right. This sucks.
If people want to follow me, I'm at Filmette on Twitter. You can follow my career from there. Website, notthatvanessawilliams.com. I'll see you on the other side.
Don't worry. I survived a few things with Kelly. I think you'd be okay on this show with disagreements on movie quality.
I don't want to take away from your joy. And, I especially like if this hit you just the right way when you saw it, I can see that it's unique. It's big. It's crazy. It's cool for the time. I just say watching it now for me was it just felt really pacing was weird.
Yeah, and sure. And what it really was for me was I just thought that book was gorgeous. I thought it was a gorgeously written book, and I thought the movie was a really nice adaptation of it. That's why Queen of the Damned was such a disappointment.
So, did you read any of her other books? Are they all kind of equally good?
No. I think the first two vampire books are really good, and I think she had a book called The Mummy that I really liked, and the first couple of the Mayfair Witches books were pretty good. And they all just kind of devolve into real melodramatic romance novels with, you know, vampires or whatever. Gotcha. And the you know, you pick up on the whole gay subtext. They're super gay in the book.
Oh,
Lestat
really?
And Louis are your vampire older gay uncles.
Yeah. They're not
so
subtle.
That's so good.
I think the combination of the interview and Lestat is just one of the great writing accomplishments.
Yeah.
I think those two are phenomenal. I absolutely love that. My favorite part in Interview was that one scene where, or that one part where they reverse it and you see it from Lestat's.
Yes.
And I find out, oh, that's pretty much what the entire second novel is. Yeah. I got it. And they're really good.
Mm.
I didn't read a lot more from her, but those are phenomenal.
Nice. Okay. Well, if I am getting the hankering to read a semi, like a flowery, but
gothic,
powerful, gothic vampire tale, I know. I think I have it somewhere.
Most horror people do.
Yeah.
Speaking of what most horror people have books from.
Ooh.
Finally, this is a first time viewing. I have not seen this yet, which might surprise some of you here, but I'm going to be talking about 2019's Doctor Sleep.
When I was a kid, there was a place. A dark place. They closed it down and let it rot. But the things that lived there. They come back.
Not many ride the bus this far north. You're running away from something?
I'm running away from myself, I guess.
Hi. You can hear me. You're magic. Like me.
I don't know about magic. I always called it the Shining. The world is a hungry place. A dangerous place.
These people, they hurt people like us.
These hinted devils, they'll eat what shines. And they've noticed that little girl.
Well, hi there.
Get out of my head! Get
out! I haven't felt power like that in so long.
They're coming.
There's a place. You sure you want to do this?
I'm ready.
Yes, you run, dear. And then I will find you. And you will scream for years.
Come play with us forever and ever.
So, you know, another kind of big author, Anne Rice to Stephen King. I don't know where you get larger from that. But this was, like I said, 2019, the Rotten Tomatoes on it was 78 from the critics, 89 from the audience. Budget pushes a boundary of calling it big budget, but I shoehorned that in because this was highly anticipated. It wasn't a surprise coming out of nowhere. It had a $45 million budget, which isn't small, but also isn't Marvel.
Vanessa, would you like to explain the rules of this subgenre to Eric? Because clearly he did not understand the assignment.
Nah, she don't care.
No, I think it's too late.
That's right. Box office was less than stellar. Did $36 million in the U.S. and $72 million worldwide. But directed by, longtime listeners will know, one of my favorite directors, Mike Flanagan, who you might know from Midnight Mass. The upcoming Fall of the House of Usher. Will it be based on the book, though? Who knows? And, of course, Absentia. Stars, Ewan McGregor, who for a brief period in the 90s became like one of my favorite actors after Trainspotting and Shallow Grave.
I searched
out a shitload of his films. He also was in a really interesting movie you don't hear a lot about called Brassed Off.
Oh, yeah.
So he did some really, really good shit. Kylie Curran, who is in the upcoming Fall of the House of Usher, and Lego Star Wars Summer Vacation.
Yeah.
Cliff Curtis, as in Sunshine, Training Day, a whole bunch of the upcoming Avatar movies. Anybody here really excited, waiting desperately to see the new Avatar movies?
No.
I can't wait to see all four of the new Avatar movies.
Exactly.
Yes. I can't wait to watch this. They really struck when the iron was hot. Smart.
This is an adaptation of Doctor Sleep, which I haven't read, and I know you have. So it's a semi-sequel to The Shining, yes, in some ways. The movie opens up with a little girl and a strange group of people talking to her in a woods, and they appear to then, I would say, consume her. You know, it's not like a vampire. It's not like a energy thing, but it looks akin to like a soul stealing, like you've seen in some movies before. And then we move quickly to the beginning of one of the first recreation scenes of Danny riding his big wheel through the Overlake Hotel, which I love in the original Shining. I love that sequence because it's just this amazing hypnotic scene. It doesn't run long enough to do that in this film, but it's there and it's kind of cool. And I thought it was really interesting then that as he's growing up a little bit, this is taking place. He's still a child, but they're no longer at the Overlake, and he is seeing the 237 woman in his own bathroom now. So she's kind of followed him. And the idea being that the Shining goes where he goes. So some of the aspects of it follow him and find him. I didn't quite get that right off the bat, but by the end of the movie, it's like, oh, okay. And I forgot the actor's name, forgot to write it down. The guy in The Shining who helps him.
Scatman Crothers?
Yeah, Scatman Crothers. His character shows up as kind of an imaginary friend, I guess you could say, to Dan, because, you know, he's now an adult, getting towards adult, but a Danny telling him, you know, you got to box up your feelings of the Overlake. You got to create these little boxes and trap everything.
Overlook.
Keep calling it Overlake.
I'm going to have to say something.
Oh, yeah, definitely. The Overlake Look Hotels with the fun water slides. But so he does that. And as he grows up, he learns that maybe that might not have been such the best thing for him. He's still haunted by things. He appears to be a raging alcoholic. He gets in horrible, horribly violent fights. Almost steals from a woman he's sleeping with, or had a one-night affair with. And so he's kind of not doing great. At the same time, we're introduced to a little girl. The introduction is weird. I didn't quite understand. It's so subtle, I didn't realize, oh, this is actually going to be one of the main characters in this movie. It's just like, oh, there's a creepy haunted piano. The group is, they call the True Knots, and it's almost like they're forming a super group of Shining people. as it goes on, the movie explains a little bit more that they actually have a long history. Not really what that history is, just that they have a long history. It's okay. At this point, I'm kind of like, well, it's fun. The acting is incredible, so it's neat to watch. They have a great scene in a theater where the True Knots find their next, not their next victim, but the next person to join their group, because I think they call her a pusher. And it's like, well, we haven't had a pusher in years. So a pusher seems to be somebody who basically gets you to do things, forces you, says stuff, and you do it. Apparently the other people all have powers too, but they really don't explain what those powers might be. Hers seems to be to find these people and understand what their powers might be. And they have a pretty gruesome scene where they kidnap and torture and kill a kid baseball player. And the indication is that the fear and the pain make them more delicious and powerful to eat. Well, while this is happening, the young lady you met earlier feels this stuff and also shares it with Danny, who is now grown up and sobered up. I think he's 8 years sober by the time these things start to happen. He's lived in this neat apartment place he gets. Man, what a hell of an apartment for $85 a week.
Yeah.
And one of the walls is all slate, so you can chalk draws on it, and the little girl draws messages to him, and he talks back a little bit. That aspect of the movie, just because it was neat to see Ewan McGregor in a small role again. Yeah, because he's fine as Obi-Wan, but I think he is so much better as a interesting character, somebody who's troubled and doing something and just trying to be a better person. All those movies I mentioned before, Trainspotting, Shallow Grave, and Brastoff, that's what he's doing. Trying to deal with the shit he's doing. And he does that here, and I think he's really good at it. Then they sort of realize, okay, they're going to hunt down the girl because she obviously has a lot of power. So Danny and her find each other, and he brings his buddy along. It's like, oh, there's somebody they can kill. Sort of the thought there. From there, a large portion of the movie is, let's get together and battle these people. Let's stop the lady from getting it. Let's stop this from happening. It's all actually a pretty good film. But it is, until one point, it doesn't make any sense as a Shining sequel, other than the loosest connection. Of course, the final battle then moves to the Overlook Hotel, where it intersects, and there's neat connections to The Shining, like the interview room earlier in the movie when Dan's getting interviewed for the cleaning up in the old folks' home. It's an exact replication of the office that Jack was interviewed in the original Shining. I mean, right down to the flag on the... It's all there. It is the same office, which... Why? But I'll tell you, there's a moment in this movie, for a little emotional moment here, that hit me like a ton of fucking bricks. Because there's that story of it's a real story of the little cat that detects when people are dying and will go and lay at the bottom of their beds. Well, Danny has a cat like that where he works, and he goes in and helps people die. He comforts them and they die. And it just, you know, connected hard with me because my mom and her hospice stuff. I'm going, man, I wish my mom had a cat like that. Yeah. But, again, the performances are so good. I really like Flanagan's filmmaking style. Even when his movies are okay, I still think they are interesting to watch, and he does neat stuff, and he always gets good performances out of good actors. Sometimes some of his movies have not great actors, but they're still good. But if they're good, they're a lot of fun to watch in his films. When it gets to the Overlook, I enjoyed it. It felt much more like a Shining sequel. It was kind of fun to watch. It was, but at the same time, not the most memorable part of the movie. when I think back of watching this film, it's a lot of the stuff that happened before they got to the Overlook. They had Danny makes an appearance in the movie. The original Danny is in, I think, the AA meetings or something like that. But Jack Nicholson did not want to do. He was retired from acting, and Flanagan in the interview said he's going to respect that. So he didn't try to work real hard to talk him into doing this stuff because he really wanted to be retired. He's like, okay, you'll be retired. And they hired a guy who kind of looked like him.
Like Jack?
Jack, the bartender. Oh, had a,
that was Henry Thomas.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Oh, okay. Wild. That's cool. And the woman who played Danny's mom, kind of like a Shelley Duvall-ish.
Yeah.
But so it's interesting, the looks and everything, the colors, the way the rooms were set up and everything was meticulously recreated. The tone of the entire film also smashes into a different world when they go to the Overlook. It is a entirely different feeling film. I'm curious, as the Stephen King aficionado around us, what was your thoughts on this movie?
I liked it until they got up to the Overlook. Flanagan had a really impossible task of trying to make a sequel, an adaptation of the book that was also a sequel to the movie.
Yes.
Because the movie is so different from the original book also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, in the book, the Overlook is destroyed.
Right.
So, but not in the movie. So he brings them back to kind of a falling apart Overlook, and then gives us the greatest hits of The Shining with those scenes, which I did not care for. And also, we had already established that that Danny and his friend had sniper rifles, and I'm like, well, why don't we just sit in one of the windows and shoot her as she's coming up the road? Why do we have to actually engage her physically where we know she can do some real damage?
They died real easy. Yeah. That was a little surprise at how easily her little crew was killed.
So I like the book a lot more than I like the movie. And it is a sequel to The Shining. If you understand the book, The Shining is not about this haunted hotel. It's about this father and his son and the ravages of alcoholism and how you pass that on to your child. Mm-hmm. You know, Danny has grown up to be his father at the beginning of Dr. Sleep.
They needed a lot more of that. It's that was very quickly resolved.
Impossible to tell a story like that unless you've got 800 pages, you know? So I just think that it was, I love Flanagan. I wish he had picked a different book to adapt because I felt like this was a guaranteed failure.
The scene, and when they were doing the greatest hits, as you mentioned, I like that term, the bit that was like, some of them like, fine, okay, those kind of contribute to what you're doing. You're turning the power of the Overlook back on, whatever. But the scene when she enters and they do the blood of the elevator and she just looks at it like, huh.
That's cute.
And it's like, that's really weird. Well, anyways, notes and trivia tagline. A new chapter from Stephen King, author of The Shining.
Oh, good. Beautiful.
To the point.
Yeah. The world will shine again.
Oh, no.
Dare to go back. The next chapter in The Shining story.
Okay.
So he actually acquired blueprints from Stanley Kubrick's estate of the way the Overlook was done in The Shining. Mm-hmm. So he could recreate it as accurately as possible. Yeah, I already talked about that it's identical as Duff's. It took a lot of work for Flanagan to do this because Stephen King didn't want to sign off on it. Largely because, he did not like that adaptation of his book at all. He really, really didn't like it. So he had to balance out making Stephen King happy and then try to figure out. I mean, it was the impossible task. You're talking about one of the top three horror films ever made, and a great film made, period. One of the masterpieces by one of the masters, and the most successful novelist our country's ever seen. And it's just like, wow, dude, pulling off a lot to chew there.
Big balls.
Yeah, yeah. No kidding. Boy, a lot of notes here that we've already talked about.
Do you know if Stephen King liked the final product? If he liked,
of the of new Doctor one, Sleep. Doctor Sleep. Mm-hmm. I think he was fine with it. It didn't quite go Anne Rice on it like you were talking about.
In an interview with Flanagan said that King told him, "You did the best possible job you could by pleasing fans of the book and the movie."
Yeah. So that's,
I mean, the problem is The Shining was a flop when it came out.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And it's that whole thing of like Blade Runner 2049, you know, being a flop. And I'm like, well, what did you expect? Nobody liked the first movie either.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got its fans, but here we go again. We'll make a big budget sequel to a movie that was a flop, and then we'll be surprised that it is also a flop.
The weirdness, I think, with Blade Runner and The Thing and The Shining is these are all films that film nerds and film geeks have absolutely embraced,
right?
And filmmakers as being the brilliant films they are. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the general public that doesn't watch four or five movies a week or more is beyond going, oh, whatever. Well, I don't remember that movie.
I mean, a cult classic means that it has a cult-like following, and those cultists don't want to see the thing that they love and cherish be remade for a wider audience.
Right.
So it does feel like a really big misstep. Yeah.
So the Brian Tallarico of RogerEbert.com gave the film 3 out of 4, stating Flanagan was tasked with making a sequel to a film that stays loyal to a book that ignores the changes made in the first movie. That ain't easy. And while one can sometimes feel Flanagan struggling to satisfy both King and Kubrick fans, when he really should be trusting his own vision, he's talented enough to pull off the difficult blend of legacies. It's like, yeah, I think if he'd just gotten Stephen King to write off on it, get the Kubrick estate to give him what he needed and just made a Flanagan film,
yeah,
he might have been a little more successful, but there is definitely a lot of, I'm trying to please everybody in this movie.
Yeah.
But he did adapt a lot of Stephen King stories, so.
Yeah, and I'll be honest. I think this is the best acting Ewan McGregor has done in 25 years.
Oh, yeah.
I thought he was spectacular. He brought me to tears a couple of times when he was at rock bottom.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He is fantastic. He is the guy I fell in love with watching on Shallow Grave and Trainspotting. And I've watched Trainspotting as recently as like 2 years ago, and it is still absolutely a masterpiece. It's an incredible film. I need to watch Shallow Grave again, too. That one's disturbing. This did get 12 different film groups from Fangoria to the Utah Film Critics to nominate it for a variety of awards, several Best Pictures and acting nominations, with Rebecca Ferguson winning in several categories. And she played the Hat, Mrs. Hat. I forget the exact
name. Yeah, she was great, too.
She was so good.
Yes. Yeah, all the the performances keep the movie moving and worth watching. The story's just so tough.
Remind me, was the little girl in this, was she the little girl that couldn't walk at the beginning of Midnight Mass?
Oh.
I think so.
Or am I misremembering? I don't know.
He's the Flaniverse.
He's got a touch with children.
Yeah.
You know, I do not like precocious kids, and he doesn't have his kids precocious. Mm-hmm. They all seem like good, solid actors.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, and they did have the hand damage.
I know. I was going to say, we need a trigger warning to at least let people know, if you're worried about the degloving that he is obsessed with, there's a great moment in here for you.
Yep. So, but the kid will be in Fall of House of Usher. Of course, she's a little older now.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's kind of like the third part of his.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Netflix.
Blind Manor, and then it is Netflix, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. So, well, I'm looking forward to it. I don't think it's going to be. I don't think it's an adaptation of the book at all. I think it's like a sequel to it.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised, because he didn't adapt the first one he did, but Midnight Mass certainly was a step into the right direction of. Damn, that's good.
Yeah,
this is a complicated film, because I like so much about it, but I just don't think that I don't think it nailed it.
Yeah, it's very wavy watching this movie, where I was like, I watched the director's cut too. I watched the 3-hour cut of it. And there are points I'm going, oh man, this movie is like, what is going on here? Mm-hmm. And then something else will happen. And you're like, oh man, I have totally enjoyed this movie. Then half an hour later, you're kind of like, hmm. But
I think
it's worth watching.
I definitely had a very similar reaction to Kelly, where I was really digging the movie in the theater and just going, oh man, this is actually good. Oh, this is actually good. I mean, a few moments of like, and then, but this is really good. And then they went to the hotel and I was like, what the fuck is this film? This is a piece of trash. And I think there's a moment where they're looking over the railing and it's like, all the ghosts of the Overlook are just staring at them. Yeah. And I was like, this is some bad CGI with some hokey ass shit. It is really misunderstood what was interesting about that in the film, which again, like you said, I mean, it's impossible. It's an impossible task. It's like, why? Just don't do it. Don't do it.
But also you got like a stupid scene like that. Mm-hmm. But I remember seeing this in the theater and I had my hands over my eyes while they were killing that little kid from the baseball league.
Jeez, that was so brutal.
I was horrified and terrified the entire time going, oh my God, I can't believe I'm watching this.
The good part of the movie. Yes, so good. And like even being in that room of boxes was still, it was visually really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, cool, guys. We have a little break in our schedule because this is not your time, Eric.
That's
giving this next subgenre pick to Micah, who donated a considerable amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to be doing mid-70s sci-fi, yeah.
I thought you said midsummer? We're doing midsummer? We're doing midsummer. All three of us.
That'll be interesting. You.
70s sci-fi. Eric, in fact, walked in on me today while I was watching my 70s sci-fi movie. So,
you're really jumping the gun.
Well,
you're really ahead of the game.
Well,
some of us have to pick movies. Some of us have to decide.
We're doing it one week from today.
Well,
you sometimes pick movies at what, like midnight Saturday before we record?
No one needs to know that. No one needs to understand my process. It's a secret, sacred method.
So
keeps it fresh in my head, okay?
Okay.
With that, let me remind all the listeners, you can be like Micah and send money our way if you want to hear us talk about various things. We love that. We also love when you like and share the posts and when you send us messages like Will did. Like Mike DeBronzo always is sending me stuff. And everybody who reaches out and just says hi, really, really appreciate that.
That's great. Get out there and give us some reviews, too. It's been a while since we've had any reviews. Pump them up. And you go back to the way old school of the 5-star. Give the 5-star review and challenge me to watch a film. It's a lot harder to find a film that I'm going to think is pure crap after the series of Andy Mulligan movies and other things I've watched since we started this podcast. But I like
I like that you decided, well, I'm going to watch Child's Play. I've been watching shitty movies all this time, so how about something else?
Something different.
Okay, gang, how about we take a break for 7 days and we come back here and we talk 70s sci-fi.
Sounds good.
Cool. Bye. Transportation and other considerations for Strange Eons Radio produced by Pan Am Airlines. When you think of traveling, think of Pan Am. You can't beat the experience. Guests of Strange Eons Radio stay at Econo Lodge Everett. It's an easy stop on the road, you know what I mean. Strange Eons Radio is recorded live in front of a studio audience. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a positive review on your favorite podcast app. Sit, Ubu, sit.
I wanted to know if I was wrong, and it turns out I was really right.